First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Can your employer make you get the vaccine? Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we're going to tell you what the law says about vaccine mandates and also mask wearing at your office. Let us know how things are where you work. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, we speak with the co-author of the new bestseller on the final year of the Trump presidency, I Alone Can Fix It. That's later. But first, this hour, the Biden administration is expected to announce today new vaccination requirements for federal employees and federal contractors. It's anticipated that they will be required to show their vaccination status to come to work or submit to regular COVID testing. Now, of course, here in Florida, Governor DeSantis passed a law along with the legislature forbidding these sorts of vaccine requirements for the workplace. However, increasingly at the national level, entities are moving in this direction, a number of them, both private and government. So it got us to wondering how this might play out in Florida over time. We have an expert on the line right now, Lindsay Swiger. She's an employment attorney with Jackson Lewis here in town, and she's on the line to tell us what our employer can do to keep the workplace safe. Hi, Lindsay. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
So good to have you. Give us a call, folks. Let us know what the situation is at your workplace when it comes to keeping people safe from COVID-19. Or if you have concerns about that, let us know your opinion on whether you think a business should be allowed to mandate vaccination for its employees as a condition of coming back into the office. The number to join us, 549-2937. Already getting your calls. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, and our Facebook page, as always, is open on this. So, Lindsay, what is the situation here in Florida? It seems to be a bit like the Wild West. Can you bring us up to date on what the law says for employers in the Sunshine State?
Absolutely, Melissa. I will do my best. This is an area where we are seeing a lot of changes just this week. For those listeners who were on the line and heard the national news update, they heard a story about the announcement expected out of the Biden administration today regarding federal government workers, as well as the updated CDC guidance regarding masking for vaccinated individuals. So we're seeing a lot of changes, and for those employers and employees who were looking at this last week, that's already out of date, and we're on to something new this week. And even later today, we'll have some additional new information. And the reason that we all of us need to be paying attention to the announcement out of the Biden administration is that even though we expect that those new rules to be focused on federal employees, it may also extend to federal government contractors. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our First Coast businesses are federal contractors. And so everyone will need to be paying close attention to that announcement that we expect to have later today.
Right. It could affect a lot of employees out there listening right now. 549-2937. Give us a call. So Mayo Clinic came out this week and announced mandatory vaccine requirements for their staff. St. Vincent's as well. The VA is the first federal agency to mandate vaccination for most of its staff. Do you think we'll see more of this?
I do, Melissa. We are hearing at Jackson Lewis a lot of clients coming back to us with questions on whether to initiate a policy to require vaccination to return to the work site. And especially in the area of healthcare and long-term care and child care, those industries are especially focused on vaccination and improving and incentivizing vaccination rates among their workforce because they are essential and because they're on the front lines and most at risk for contracting COVID-19. So we do anticipate employers to at least give this a thought and consideration at this time as the COVID-19 rates are increasing. And here in our local area, we're seeing, you know, the CDC is reporting that we're in a substantial area.
We are perhaps the biggest hotspot in the country right now. Yeah, in Jacksonville, unfortunately. But, Lindsay, what about Florida? There is a law the governor pushed that bans what he calls vaccine passports, demanding to know someone's vaccination status to come into their workplace or to come into any kind of large-scale event, that kind of thing. He's been fighting with the cruise ship companies on this. Some of them are going to defy him and continue to require proof of vaccination to embark on a ship. But where does that leave businesses in Florida that want to make sure all of their employees are vaccinated? That currently is against Florida law.
Well, actually, Melissa, I'd like to make a correction there.
Okay.
The law that you're talking about, it does prohibit Florida businesses for asking for proof of vaccination status or vaccine passports from their customers or their or consumers.
But not employees.
But not employers and not employees. And
okay.
So it is still possible in Florida for employers to have a vaccination policy or to ask for the vaccination status of employees. Although I would say that there are many legal considerations and practical considerations that employers should think through and receive the advice of their legal counsel before rolling something like this out.
Like what? I'm so curious to hear what, because just yesterday, the head of our HR department at WJCT Public Media said, man, am I going to be listening to this show? Businesses are wondering how they should proceed.
Right. So there are, several pros to having a vaccine mandated policy in your workplace that encourages employees to become vaccinated. It may help to lead employees to feel more comfortable returning to the work site. Your customers and your clients may feel more comfortable knowing that your workforce is vaccinated. However, there are legal restrictions, and I'll be focusing my comments on the federal landscape. And so there we're talking about Title VII and the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. Those are laws that many of your listeners may be familiar with, at mm-hmm. least to some degree. But it's also important to keep in mind that for our multi-state employers who have operations not only in Florida, but throughout the United States, there are local and state laws that they'll need to consider and that may restrict what they can do or may allow them to do more than what they can do in Florida. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead, please.
So at the federal level, the Americans with Disabilities Act is our biggest concern when we're talking about mandating the vaccine. And Americans with Disabilities Act, or the ADA, prohibits discrimination against individuals with disabilities, and it requires employers to provide a reasonable accommodation to individuals with disabilities.
Right.
And those, of course, are legal terms that, have requirements.
Sure.
Generally speaking.
But what I hear you saying is if an employer decides to require vaccination for its workforce, there need to be carve outs for certain categories of employees, the immunocompromised, those who have a sincerely held, maybe religious belief that they can say prohibits vaccination. Some parents do that with their children. They file exemptions for childhood immunizations. So employers have a lot to consider, right?
That's absolutely right. And so if you are going to roll out a mandatory vaccination policy, you want to make sure that you have a process in place for responding to the request for a reasonable accommodation from individuals who may have medical conditions that prevent them from being able to obtain the vaccine, those with the sincerely held religious beliefs, as you mentioned, pregnant employees who may have been advised by their healthcare providers not to receive the vaccine. And so you need to have an alternative in place for those individuals. And the EEOC has suggested, masking, social distancing, allowing those employees to continue to work remotely if that's a possibility, you know, setting up a workspace where they have distance and those kinds of things that could be alternatives to a vaccination policy.
We're speaking with employment attorney Lindsay Swiger of the Jackson Lewis firm in Jacksonville. Increasingly, both government agencies and private companies are now going to be requiring vaccination for employees to come back onto the property of their business. The Biden administration expected to announce requirements today for federal employees and federal contractors. A number of tech giants are doing the same. Facebook, Google, they're both going to require their workers to get vaccinated. Major League Baseball requiring its staff to be vaccinated as of August, and a number of others, including Mayo Clinic here in Jacksonville, St. Vincent's as well. Let us know your thoughts about this, and let us know how things are at your workplace. 549-2937. David is in Green Cove Springs. Hi, David. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning, Melissa. How you doing?
All right, thanks. It's another day in paradise, right? As we try to survive. Go ahead, David.
You live in a strange paradise, I tell you that.
Don't I know it?
What it is, everybody doesn't want their rights infringed on, but when people don't get the vaccination, they infringe on other people's rights by spreading the virus. This virus would have been done. We would have reached herd immunity, and we would have been almost out of the woods with this. I can't understand why the politics gets in the way. Governor DeSantis, he's a major disappointment, as far as I'm concerned, that he doesn't realize that this is hurting our economy, this is killing people, and we could have been done with this. We could have been putting the nail in the coffin, and this whole virus would have been, looking in the rearview mirror, would have been done.
David, I completely understand your frustration. That said, we do need to be fair-minded in pointing out that even countries that have been much more aggressive with the kinds of measures that would mitigate the spread of the virus are still struggling. So I guess that just speaks to the persistence of this virus and the way it's mutating. I just want to give that caveat, okay? That said, Lindsay Swiger, what about his comments?
I think that he is expressing a frustration that a lot of people share. But then on the other side, there are individuals who are equally as passionate about not wanting to be required to have the vaccination. There are many things that employers can do to encourage their workforce to become vaccinated that are short of a vaccine mandate.
Like, look at the NFL, for example, Lindsay, the Jacksonville Jaguars. They're doing a combination of the carrot and the stick to make their players get the vaccine.
Right, and all businesses can do some form of the carrot and to try to encourage their workforce to get vaccinated. It can be something as simple as a T-shirt or a hat. Additional paid time off to individuals who are vaccinated, paid time off to get the vaccine and to recover from any symptoms that people may experience following the vaccine. So there are a lot of options for businesses to incentivize and encourage vaccination to help us to achieve the herd immunity that we are looking to get to.
Bob in Atlantic Beach. Hello, Bob. How are you today? Go ahead.
I am doing well, thank you, and I hope you guys continue to do well also.
Thank you.
I wanted to discuss the problem that our politicians are creating with different laws. I work for a very different kind of business. I'm a tugboat captain. We have a contract that leaves Jacksonville and goes to the Bahamas. We sail with six people on the boat. By Florida law, I cannot ask anybody getting on the boat if they have been vaccinated or not. Mm. But before I can get to the Bahamas, I have to have them show me vaccination passports. When I get to my destination, I also have to have them provide copies the vaccinations to the local authorities. The difference in laws is almost impossible. And when you throw in the religious exemptions and stuff like that, it makes it extremely hard to comply with.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Bob, do me a favor. Stay on hold so we can get your number. That might make for a good follow-up news story, okay? Thank you. I'm going to put you on hold and grab your contact information. Wow. Okay, so Lindsay, just picture Bob on his tugboat trying to comply with different jurisdictions, not just domestic, but also international, and run the business that he's in. That just kind of makes my head spin.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Bob, you know, you're not alone. There are many businesses that operate in, you know, throughout the United States and then internationally, as Bob's business does. And he's absolutely right. There's a patchwork of laws, you know, that can go from the federal to the state, even down to counties and cities. And it is very difficult for employers to comply and to stay in compliance as the legal landscape changes and fluctuates. And the best thing for our employers to do is to just try as hard as they can to stay up to date, to sign up for, you know, email blasts, and to do what, and to seek legal counsel, especially in a situation like what Bob has, where he is traveling, internationally with his workforce, to make sure that he is, you know, protecting his business as well as the folks that he has working for him.
It's 549-2937. Here's an email from a listener. I'm listening and I'm grateful for this broadcast today. I'm concerned about doctor's offices, dentist's offices, grocery stores, salons, restaurants, where the public assumes those helping them are safe. We need vaccinations and masks. Another tweet from Joss. I am totally opposed to these measures for a disease with a 98%+ survival rate. Some people have legitimate reasons for declining the vax. These requirements will sow more division, resentment, and anger, he says. Okay, so Lindsay, that gives you a sense of the divide in this country and in this community over this issue.
Absolutely, and it's real, and we all see it in our own, you know, workplaces and out in the world when we're out, you know, for those of us who are going out shopping and going to restaurants, you see it everywhere that we're going. And there are legitimate concerns that employees may have, in addition to the ones that we've talked about, you know, disability and religion and pregnancy, for those who choose for other reasons not to become vaccinated and therefore may be required to wear a mask and socially distance in the workplace, they may feel as if they are suffering from something that is being called unconscious proximity bias, where they are not having the same level of access to leadership, you know, mentorship, assignments, promotional opportunities because of their decision not to have the vaccination and therefore being required to, you know, wear a mask and socially distance. And so there are a lot of, employee, what we call employee relations issues that all employers have to think through and decide what is the best way to communicate with their workforce that reflects their culture and their objectives and their goals. While making their entire workforce feel welcomed and heard and appreciated in these, you know, very difficult times.
Dave emails the show, when it comes to work vaccinations, it's about time. Once again, I suspect the loudest voices against the idea in the name of freedom are the very folks who are least likely to be actually exercising their own freedom of choice, he says. You know, Jessica's on the line. We'll go to her in a minute. Lindsay Swiger, could this whole fight make its way to the high court? Florida's doubling down on its law on vaccine passports and such. How do you expect this to be litigated?
There are many lawsuits already on file throughout the United States on all of these issues. So far, we've seen many of the early legal claims against mandatory vaccinations being dismissed and not moving forward in the early stages. However, we expect that those claims will be further, you know, finessed and fine-tuned, and that they will continue.
Continue.
And what? Yeah.
Let me get one more call in. It's Jessica in Palm Coast. Hi, Jessica. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. So I recently had a bone marrow transplant and am unable to get vaccinated, so I'm very sensitive to this issue. Mm-hmm. And I hire a lot of independent contractors to help around the home, acupuncturists, yoga instructors, and I require them to be vaccinated in order for me to have, you know, to continue with their service. Are there any implications in requiring vaccinations for independent contractors?
Thanks for that question, Jessica. Lindsay.
Jessica, that is a very interesting question. And in terms of, I'm not sure that I've exactly understood it, because I could see this going two ways. So I'll answer this way. In terms of being, you know, a homeowner and having folks come into your home as independent contractors to, you know, do work on you personally, you know, as an acupuncturist or a massage therapist, if you're receiving their services, just like with your lawn service or something like that. I am not aware of any restrictions preventing you from asking for a vaccination status or requiring that those folks that you hire in independent contractor status be vaccinated. Now, if you're a business and these are independent contractors that you engage with in order to provide services to your customers, there may be some additional considerations that you would want to think through before requiring vaccination or requesting information about their vaccination status, such as, you know, how you're going to maintain that information in a confidential manner and those kinds of issues.
This is a fluid situation, but I hope, Lindsay, you'll come back, because of course things will change as we move along. Thanks so much for your insights about the workplace today. It is so valuable to get this information out. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. I'm happy to come back anytime you want, Melissa.
She's attorney Lindsay Swiger, specializing in employment law with the Jackson Lewis firm here in Jacksonville. We'll keep up on that with her and others, because things could change, as I said. Meanwhile, much more still ahead on the show later in the hour, performer Bob White. But up next.
Every time we sat down with people, Phil and I could feel our jaws opening and dropping. Just every moment that they described about their experience in this presidency was spine tingling.
A conversation with Carol Leonig, co-author of the runaway bestseller on the final year of the Trump presidency, I Alone Can Fix It. That's next. A new bestseller is billed as the definitive behind-the-scenes account of Donald Trump's final year in office. What was really going on around the president as the government failed to contain the coronavirus and over half a million Americans died? Who was influencing Trump after he refused to concede an election he had clearly lost and spread lies about election fraud? New reporting reveals a dysfunctional and bumbling presidency's inner workings in unprecedented and stunning detail. For more, I spoke with Carol Leonig, co-author of the bestseller, I Alone Can Fix It, Donald J. Trump's Catastrophic Final Year.
Hi, Carol. Great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us, and congratulations on the success of the book.
Oh, thank you, Melissa. I'm so glad to be here with you.
This book is so full of revelations about the final year of the Trump presidency. It's really hard to know where to begin. I guess let's begin at the beginning, when you track the White House's first realization of the virus coming out of Wuhan, China, and their initial response to that. And as you go through everything that happened in 2020, what sticks out for me about this book is how time and time again, the president made decisions that were in his best political interest, not in the best interest of the public and their health. What was it like for you and your co-author, Philip Rucker, to interview sources about this and realize just how really shocking some of these conversations and decisions were?
Melissa, I love this question, genuinely, and I'm not just trying to flatter you, because as a reporter, the most important thing you want from any sit-down is the truth. You want to understand what happened, and you want them to share every little detail. And every single time, with a few exceptions, rare, every time we sat down with people, Phil and I could feel our jaws opening and dropping. You know, just every moment that they described about their experience in this presidency was spine tingling. Even though we are, I think, good reporters, very good reporters who delivered a lot of good information in real time in the Washington Post for the public, we were stunned by what we learned when we went back for this deeper excavation. And you hit it exactly, the nail on the head, about the president's MO, which was everything else be damned, but my reelection, my political gain, my quest to not just maintain my grip on power, but to sort of win every daily and hourly news cycle. One thing I came away from this with was realizing that every single ardent supporter of the president who wanted, I should say, let me re-clarify, so many of the president's most ardent supporters working to reelect him, wanting to achieve his agenda, so many of them were in a panic mode about the degree to which he was willing to put American lives in danger and to put the democracy in danger for his own gain. A couple of examples, you know, Attorney General Bill Barr. Most people realize that this Attorney General was a huge booster for Trump, would do almost anything for him, and believed strongly in getting him reelected. And yet, according to our reporting with sources, Bill Barr's experience was traumatic because behind the scenes, he was trying every which way that he could to keep the president from sicking the armed military, the active duty military, on protesters in Portland, in Oregon, in Washington, D.C. He wanted to stop the president from doing that. He knew it could be a Waco. He knew it could be fatal. Americans on the other end of a military gun, all of that would be toxic and ready for danger. There was Mark Milley, not a politician, but a person definitely trying to serve the president, chosen as the chairman of the
Joint Chiefs.
By Donald.
Yeah.
Sorry?
Yeah, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time. Yeah.
Yes, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley. Now, he's not a politician. He's not trying to get Trump reelected, so I'll make that small tweak, but he is a supporter in the sense that Trump is his president. He wants to give him the best military advice. And Trump is the person who chose him for this job, mostly to spite General Mattis, the former Secretary of Defense, who did not like General Milley. General Milley becomes concerned that there is a coup afoot in the fall and the winter of 2020. He thinks Trump and his allies are essentially trying to get their hands on the agencies, what he calls the guys with the guns, to his mentors and friends. He's trying to get his hands on the guys with the guns, the FBI, the CIA, and the Pentagon, so that he can force his will and make sure that he keeps power and avoid a peaceful transfer of power.
Right.
And,
yeah, I mean, Milley even talked about this as something of a Reichstag fire moment, drawing parallels between the Trump presidency and the origins of Nazi Germany. So, but let me ask you, Carol, because your sources are impeccable and you and Philip Rucker spoke to so many people in the administration or close to it who tell these incredible tales. What would you say to those reading these accounts who feel that these people who were in a position of influence should have been sounding the alarm earlier about the dangers of the Trump presidency?
You know, that is a position that, as reporters, Bill and I don't take one way or another, because it's not our business to decide who speaks up in criticism of a politician, and we wouldn't recommend one way or another. Mm-hmm. But I will say that I do have a better, you know, behind-the-scenes insight now about why so many did not speak up. In our reporting, we learn that, for example, Secretary of Defense Mark Esper is almost on a roller coaster ride in this job, where he knows Trump is furious at him for keeping him from, again, sending and unleashing military forces on protesters. Esper is another bulwark against that. He knows the president is furious at him, and he is just trying to hold on for dear life to his job because he fears what Trump will replace him with. He is worried about a series of Trump loyalists that have been installed in key jobs in the Pentagon, and he's being warned that these people are trouble and that they will do certain things that both he and Milley are fearful of. Again, do things to create chaos, create fear, a wag the dog moment, something, again, to do, you know, to consolidate Trump's power, to build upon that power and make voters fearful enough they want to turn to him. So he is, again, one of the examples of the reason people didn't come out more forcefully. He just wants to hold on to his job to prevent something worse. There are other people that were just afraid of Donald Trump, and they were afraid of what he would do to them. Remember, this is a president who, if you disputed him, would, as Esper found out in a meeting, rip your face off. That was what he was warned about. Esper apologized for his role in walking behind the president as he cleared Lafayette Square for a photo opportunity. Both Esper and Milley felt they had been used and played in that photo op, and they were distraught because they are the U.S. military. They are not political actors. They couldn't believe that peaceable protesters were removed in that way so that the president could sort of assert authority and show he was this law and order president. Again, keep in mind, chemical canisters of gas, rubber bullets, riot gear were used to shove people who were, you know, mostly chanting and praying in a public park where they're allowed to protest. Mm-hmm. They were so upset about that that Esper apologizes a few days later and explains that he does not support releasing active duty military on protesters who are exercising their First Amendment rights. And he apologizes and also adds that, you know, the racism in our country is a stain that needs to be addressed. And the U.S. military is committed to doing that and being a leader and a model In that fight.
You know, shortly after he left the White House, former President Trump hosted you and your co-author at Mar-a-Lago. And I'm just curious to ask you, sitting there with him, interviewing him for your book, which it's surprising, frankly, that he sat for the interview, but he did, along with some other authors who came to him. You sat there across the table from him. He told you he believed that he would have easily won re-election if there had not been a pandemic. He also told you a number of other things that were misleading or flat out false. Sitting there with him, did you get the sense that he believed what he was saying, truly believed it, or did you feel that he was spinning you as a journalist and an author?
I also love this question because, you know, my job as an investigative reporter relies a great deal on my ability to detect when someone is lying, to sort of sense when they're fibbing and read their body language. I don't make, you know, dispositive decisions based on that body language, but it's helpful. It's a helpful tool. And everything that the president said about the election, about COVID, about his foes, none of it had a connection to reality. None of it was moored in reality. It was easily disproven, and it was easily disproven by his own cabinet members, his own aides, who told him these things were false. But the former president is so physically committed, so deeply internally committed to this new internal narrative that is in la-la land, that I detected no deception on his part physically. From stem to stern, he looks like a person who believes it. Now, whether or not he does, I can't tell you. I will just say that it's impressive. If he is lying in his own mind, if he's intentionally lying, his body does not give it away.
Well, the start of a new school year is almost upon us, and that means that it may be time to cut down on your kids' recreational screen time. How do you do that? Dr. Jenna Wheeler has some tips. She's a pediatric critical care physician with Orlando Health Arnold Palmer Hospital for Children. Hey, Dr. Wheeler, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. And I'm excited to talk to you about this because this is a problem in our house, too. The pandemic seems to me to have made the amount of time kids spend on screens even worse. Is that what you're seeing?
Definitely. Both as a pediatrician and also as a mom myself, I think it's a topic that we all kind of have in the forefront of our minds, but we're also trying to juggle, you know, so many things that are new with this pandemic and new ways of learning and trying to juggle careers and taking care of our families and keep our kids occupied. And so I definitely think it's a good topic right now.
Yeah. A 2020 study by the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry finds kids aged 8 to 12 in the United States spend 4 to 6 hours a day on screen media, teenagers up to 9 hours. I have struggled with this as a mom. It is so difficult to tear kids away from their phones, their games, their social media, but we have to try. We have to try to limit screen time. Too much of it is just not good for them. What do you have any advice for parents out there about this? Because it's easier said than done.
It really is. You know, it's really easy to say, we'll just take away the screens, but it's not possible. It's not possible in today's day and age with everything being so technology driven. And just with everything kind of going on, I think the keys are to know what your kids are doing. The biggest thing as a parent is to monitor the amount of time. And not only the amount of time, but what is the content that they're looking at? Are they doing educational websites? Are they, you know, are they doing things that are more just social media? Just kind of know what your kid's doing. And especially as your kids get older, encourage some self-regulation. This can be a good learning process for the kids, too, to be able to negotiate some limits, to be able to self-regulate themselves, to say, hey, you know what, I'm going to spend a half hour on my iPad or my device, and then I'm going to go outside for a little bit. And just to really make sure that you kind of balance the screen time with good sleep habits, with good exercise, and then some quality time as a family where everybody in the family, not just the kids, but the grown-ups too, all have their screens off so that they can really kind of communicate and use that time to say, hey, I saw you were on your screen for a while today. What were you doing? You know, did you learn anything on it? And kind of make it a conversation point as a family.
That's great. And in this time when there's so much tension about back to school, everything is so fraught right now with battles over whether kids should be masked and worries about the spread of COVID overall. Anything we can do to dial down the temperature at home with our children, I think, is a good thing. What other advice do you have for parents who are getting ready and gearing up for back to school?
I think the biggest thing, you know, just always with parents and with families is to, you know, every family's needs are different. every family has, you know, different circumstances and situations. And so to kind of sit down with a family and say, hey, you know, these are our goals. This is the goal for us as a family as we head back into the school year. These are my concerns as a parent. What are your concerns as a kid? How can I support you as a parent? You know, there's a lot of concerns that kids have that they may not say, but if you ask them, they have some really good questions. And I think to be able to sit down and have that open communication, the more you can communicate on any front, the more than when you're getting into things like setting limits on screen time or talking about masks in school, talking about a pandemic, that open communication really goes a long way to really help with the anxiety of not only your kids, but you as a parent as well, because we really, we just want the best for our kids. And like you said, there's a lot of topics right now that are different than what we were talking about a year or two ago.
That's right. But one thing that seems to have endured is the toll this has taken on the mental health of kids and teenagers. And how are you seeing that manifest in your practice?
I think that's definitely, you know, has been a cause for concern. We've seen a lot of kids who are maybe not as closely monitored as they would have been if parents are trying to balance jobs with kids being home and childcare options being a little bit different. We're seeing kids have some increased impulsivity and making some poor choices in regards to, we've seen a number of overdoses and things like that come into our ICUs. There's definitely a concern for increase in obesity, just with all of the extra screen time and the lack of recreation as people have been, you know, cooped up inside a little bit more than normal. And we have seen an increase in depressive symptoms, but our hope is that as we're talking about it more, as we're educating more, and this is more aware for us, that we can really help these kids and these teenagers and the family unit as well.
And when you say limit screen time, what's a reasonable limit? Because as I said, kids spend up to 9 hours a day, particularly during the summer, on screen media.
Sure. If you follow a lot of the guidelines, you know, the guideline really is less than 24 months. They really shouldn't have any screen time except for video chat with an adult present being engaged. 2 to 5 years, they say, typically less than an hour a day is a good amount. And then greater than 5 years of age, it's really, you need to negotiate with your child, kind of as a family, balance it with recreation time, making sure that it's not cutting into sleep time, because every family is going to be a little bit different. And again, it goes back to also when they are on their screens, what is the content that they're looking at, and just making sure that that's a good conversation point for you as a family.
Thank you so much. Timely advice, doctor. She's Dr. Jenna Wheeler, pediatric critical care physician with Orlando Health.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And we'll all do the best we can, right, parents? Okay, a quick break. And in a moment, performer Bob White, he's back with a new Raw Talks in his series, how you can see him and friends on stage coming up soon in Jacksonville. A COVID-safe show, too, by the way. It's called What I Did With My Pandemic. That's coming up, so keep listening.
ServPro of Jacksonville South and Arlington Jacksonville East are proud to support the Funk Sotelo Foundation, helping to fund pancreatic cancer research through Mayo Clinic. To support or learn more, funksotelofoundation.org. Farrah and Farrah, dedicated to representing the injured people in Jacksonville for over 40 years. Learn more at farrahandfarrah.com or 396-5555. Farrah and Farrah's accident attorneys are here for you, here for good.
I'm Robin Young. The new documentary, Ailey, tells the story of the legendary choreographer Alvin Ailey, dance giant Judith Jameson, remembers performing his works.
You got up there and burnt up the stage and didn't leave anything for anybody else who was coming in after you to dance on because you had already done it all.
Next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, Spyware, we talk with Washington Post reporter Craig Timberg about how a private Israeli spyware company leased military-grade spyware to governments that were supposed to use it for tracking terrorists and criminals, but it was used to hack the phones of journalists, human rights activists, business executives, and others. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Officer Harry Dunn knows because he was there.
If a hitman is hired and he kills somebody, the hitman goes to jail.
What's next for the House hearing into the deadly assault on the Capitol?
There was an attack carried out on January 6th, and a hitman sent them. I want you to get to the bottom of that.
That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, performer and former cultural council chief Robert Arlie White is back with a new edition of his Raw Talks series. He'll be joined by some onstage friends as well. This new show is COVID safe and distanced and called What I Did With My Pandemic. Take a listen. Robert Arlie White, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me on today. What a treat.
I know. It's great to talk to you. Now, you have a new show coming up, part of your Raw Talk series. That's Raw for Robert Arlie White, with Charlotte Mabry, your friend and artistic partner. This is called What I Did With My Pandemic. I think we need to hear about this. What have you been doing with your pandemic?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, Melissa, I did a lot of things. I got peacekeeper training. I got end of life care training. I visited with folks. I heard stories that I want to share. One of the best stories that I want to share involves a fella here in Jacksonville, Lenny Thiessen, who was my very best friend in high school. We went to high school together in Honolulu. And in fact, I moved to Jacksonville, Florida at the beginning of my senior year of high school. So I was, you know, bitter. And Lenny showed up shortly thereafter. We both had family connections that drew us here. And it's been really, really interesting and fun to have that connection from, you know, way long ago. To keep me honest and engaged in a lot of different kinds of things. When I was 13 years old, Lenny Thiessen said to me, hey, they're having auditions after school today. We should go do that. And that is, you know, that's what put me on my life's path. And we're still talking and doing things together today.
Now, this is just an example of the kind of stories you'll share on stage with your friend Charlotte Mabry, and then also a lady named Blair Wolverton. So this is a chance to have sort of like an intimate performance with some really interesting folks on stage with you. Yeah?
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, I think Blair has been certainly iconic in certain circles in Jacksonville for a mighty long time. She is so funny and so brave and so smart. And she knows where a lot of the bodies are buried. And so as I've gotten to know her better, Blair was in my social bubble over the course of the pandemic so far. And it occurred to me at one of our meetings that I really wanted Blair to be available to tell some of the things that she knows to an audience. And when I asked her if she would do it, she said in her inimitable way, oh, honey, I have no fear of the stage. and so we were off and running from that point. But Blair is a delight. One of the real features of Raw Talks is, you know, Charlotte and I tell stories, sing songs, one thing and another. And then we also capture questions, written questions from the audience. And we're asking people to write down some questions for Blair as well. Blair did ask me, you know, what are we going to talk about? And I said, you know what? We're going to ask him some questions. It's not even interesting to me if you hear them or not. We just want you to say whatever you please.
Whatever you please.
So it'll be an interesting night.
And this will be an intimate venue. We are still in the middle of a pandemic, mm-hmm. and we are seeing a surging variant going through this community and filling up hospitals. So that's something that will be in the background of this. You want to have fun. You want to tell stories, but we're in a serious time.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's why we determined early on that we're only going to sell 25 seats per performance. And the venue will allow people to cluster in their bubbles or to sit far apart if they please. We're going to have the seats set up distanced. We're going to ask people to wear masks for sure. We're going to do everything we can to keep people safe. I've been paying really, really close attention to the good work that you've been doing on your show. And I've been paying attention to a lot of the other things that come out about the pandemic as well. I guess I was hopeful when we named the thing what I did with my pandemic because, you know, candidly, I'm still doing it. And I imagine I'm going to be doing it for a little bit.
Absolutely right. Won't we all? But this will be a good way to catch up with you, Robert Arley White, and friends at Raw Talks. This is coming up Thursday, August 5th. Through Sunday, August 8th at the Ronan School of Music on Geraldine Drive in Jacksonville. People can register at Facebook and Eventbrite. Is that right?
Eventbrite, just look for what I did with my pandemic. And I have to say that Thursday and Sunday are sold out.
Ah.
No seats available.
Oh, you're popular.
Friday's going quick and we just added Saturday. So you can still get in on Friday and Saturday night and have a fun weekend with us.
Check it out. Raw Talks with Bob White, Charlotte Mabry, and Blair Wolverton. Have a great show. Break a leg. And thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you so much. What a treat. Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Thanks also to producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, and our new associate producer, Catherine Hobbs. Welcome, Catherine. Also, editorial director Jessica Palumbo and digital editor Bill Bortsfield and the rest of the WJCT News team. You can catch our podcast up later today on all platforms and keep your feedback coming. Send those emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow for a Friday Media Roundtable. Mask up, folks. Get vaccinated.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.